Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the new book of photographs, The Theater of Insects. Right now, I'd like to welcome Rinpoche Nawangelek. He will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church at 107 West Barcelona Road here in Santa Fe in a talk titled Engaging Wisdom and Compassion. And he will be signing his book, Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So I just read your book, Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation.
Yes.
And so here we are talking about the continuity of consciousness from one life to another, which is hard for many of us, perhaps Americans or Westerners, to grasp because we don't understand the nature of consciousness itself. How is it similar to it? Because it sounds like when you write about it, like the first law of thermodynamics, namely energy can neither be created nor destroyed, it only changes forms. How is that similar to or different from the consciousness of the human being?
Very true, because according to the Buddha's teaching, the consciousness is neither could create nor could destroy. It is a continuation, but not necessarily as a human beings. Human consciousness is one of those best. When the consciousness becomes the human consciousness, it becomes the best consciousness we can ever have it. And that's why in the Buddhist tradition, Buddha tells us the human life is the most precious life we could ever have. Although Buddhism gives you a samsaric god place, not like the god, but a small g god, and which is more luxurious than that of a human life. But consider this is the most precious because it can achieve anything we wanted to do. So this is a continuation is in the Buddhist principle, yes.
So let's talk for a little more about the nature of consciousness. Is this consciousness something that will ever, do you think, be able to be described and measured physically? Is it something that physics will be able to grasp at some point?
Physically, I'm not sure, as we understand. But there's a lot of physicists today are very much interested in the how the mind functioning, and they're doing very much. There's an institute called Mind Life, and which is almost a lot of top professors from all top institutions, Harvard, MIT, the Michigan, Wisconsin, everybody's involved in that institute, and they try to figure out how the consciousness is really functioning. And what is really functioning, it is a big, hot topic in the academic field right now. And I'm not sure whether that's going to have a physical measurement or not, but scientifically, we will find some way how to explain what the consciousness really is all about it and how it functions.
So the book, Good Life, Good Death, is in many ways preparation for death, for all of us, even those of us who are not necessarily near death that we know of. When a person dies, where does consciousness go? Or I don't even know if physical space is the right metaphor. What happens to it?
This is sort of a two question. The good life, good death is not really, it is one of the most important events that we face in our life, is life and the death, both. So I think that the good death is really followed by good life. And the major emphasis on my book was a good living as well as good dying, both. And second question is, what happens to the after death. My understanding from the Buddha's teaching is it continues. And where it's going to go, whether there's a physical dimension or whether we come back in the same old place, where you, not necessarily exactly old but place, but as a human being back in our future life, and which is very much possible and happening. And the whole idea of reincarnation within the Tibetan Buddhist system is also totally based on this.
And so it's, you write about how when the person's consciousness leaves their physical body, it still exists in some form where it has a body. It's the same shape as a human body, but not the same physicality. Is that what we think of as a ghost?
Not necessarily. I think I will call it a sort of illusion body. Or I can call it, it is sort of a light natural body. It's not necessarily physical bone and flesh, but it's sort of in spirit form, not necessarily ghost. And one of these most funny thing happened in my life, and when this great American poet, Allen Ginsberg, died, and like a couple of days later, I saw his two hands, folded hand in front of me, saying thank you. That's a very funny thing. But you see nothing but the hands. So naturally, he's not carrying his hand. His hand is left with his body. But sort of, to be able to recognize, we can see that much. And that happens sometimes.
How do the Tibetan Buddhist teachings that you are talking about in this book, how are they learned? And in other words, how do people know what they know? How do you, Rinpoche, a teacher, know what you know about what happens after death? Is it something that you have evidence for?
We did learning. Is really, these are the knowledge that we have to know indirectly. There's a, in Tibetan Buddhism, we say two things. There's a direct knowledge and the indirect knowledge. The direct knowledge are the like a scientific things or what we can see with our own eyes and with what we can hear it with our ear and all that. Ear consciousness, we call it. But indirect knowledge is the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness is new things, on the basis of reliable Buddhist teachings or something like that. There are ways and means of cross-checking that as well. So through that way, and we will have indirect knowledge, and that is the, it's almost like a manual type of Buddhist teachings will tell you this thing happened, that thing happens. And so when you look at that, and then we'll see any signs or not. And then also we heavily rely on the blessings and lineage, masters, influence, and all that. Combined together, somehow we can figure it out. But however, if you ask me, is this a scientific proof? And then my answer will be no, but it's a reliable answer.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek. So in the course of a lifetime, if a person studies painting or engineering or spiritual practice, they develop from youth to maturity. Does this process of development to maturity and learning happen across lifetimes from one incarnation to another? In other words, you bring the knowledge that you had in a previous lifetime to your current life and to future lives?
This is a very interesting question. you are not supposed to. However, what happens is if you have a previous life experience and knowledge, and then when you have a new life, and at that time is much easier to learn, and that I have a direct experience on that. Because of, you know, certain things you memorize, the Tibetan way of teaching is like a good old teaching, a lot of memorization. And when certain texts that you are very easy to memorize, just by reading a couple of times, stuck in your mind, and you can say it by heart, some texts. Some texts you read through 15 times, 20 times, even then you can't repeat. And that happens even to me. And there is no other reason for me than that of previous knowledge. And that also, not only me, I've seen with a lot of younger Tibetan incarnate lamas. Knowingly, his previous incarnate lama memorized that particular text. And when you make that person to look at it, especially when the kid is younger, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, at that time, 2, 3 times reading will memorize 15, 20, 30 pages without any difficulties. And that is a reflection of previous experience in this life.
So that leads me to wonder whether, just as the human being has a life cycle, they're born as a baby, and if they live a full life, they die as an old person. Does the soul also have a life cycle?
I don't think the soul gets that old and that young. I think it remains same age, and because it's not a physical body. Physical body is a decaying by nature. And Buddhist teachings call that a perishable committee. And physically they can decrease and become weak, but mentally it does not become weak. So I don't think it exactly works the way we think, getting old and all that way. But the maturity, yes, I think the consciousness does get matured much better.
So tell us about your process of coming to understand reincarnation. You're a Tibetan born into that tradition, and in fact you were identified as the reincarnation of a previous lama, yet you yourself were resistant to the teaching of reincarnation at first.
Not only that, because I also have a very strong resistance of whatever I was told I was so and so, because I personally, I don't have any knowledge or anything of that I've been that particular person who they said I was a great scholar of 1888 or whatever that is. You know, so I have no knowledge, no proof at all, except to rely on the great masters and the teachers who confirmed me to be, and only their word I cannot ignore. And that's all I have. So which means I always hesitate for me to be claiming that, because I have nothing to show. Because yes, I was there, that is my thing, and this is my thing, and that I don't have any memory or any of that type at all. So I have a very strong hesitations on that. However, this learning part, when the learning part comes, especially memorizing things that comes, and sometimes it is much easier to memorize certain things and much more difficult to memorize certain things, which is not really depend, sometimes little depend on the text itself, but mostly some kind of a previous experience makes it easier and difficulties. For me, this is my personal experience. And I would like to say a little bit more, because I said a statement earlier, good death really depends on good life. And good life is, you know, is not what's the Western understanding of good life, and that is not luxurious and comfort and all that, but it is more rich in compassion and the wisdom. And the compassion and the wisdom that makes the life good life. Good life is really based on care, love, compassion, and the wisdom, rather than the money, luxury, and the comfort. So I just sort of thought of that I should mention it.
You make a distinction in your book when you're talking about the cause of events and whether people, for example, have an accident or a horrible death or a very pleasant and peaceful death. The distinction between causes and conditions of event. What's the difference between the cause and a condition of a person's death or any event?
The cause, for me, is understanding what I understand by saying a cause. Sort of originally, person builds a very strong karma of to be what the person be. And then the conditions are things happening to worlds materialize. Now, interesting example, let's take Obama as our newly elected president-elect. And if you look at Obama from the Buddhist eyes, you can see there is a original cause that man to be the president of the United States. He has a karma of that to be president of the United States. It is the cause that which he processed, he brought from here to this life. The conditions is like, you know, he get exposure during the John Kerry's convention. He be able to address the keynote address in the convention. And the people noticing that. And the flawless campaign that he ran. And all these become the conditions. When the right original cause karma and the right condition combined together, and then the person be able to become the president of the United States. So this is exactly how very Buddhist way of looking it, but it is the cause and the conditions, how that functions. This is just an example.
Well, that's an interesting example, and it leads to a question that I have. Let's say somebody loses their vote for president of the United States, but they cheat through manipulating the voting machines. Are they messing with karma? I mean, was it their karma to cheat and become president?
And the thing is this, let's say if something happens to the last election, right? And what happened is they did not cheat the karma, but what happened is that particular person has the karma to be a president, but his karma materialized the wrong way, because of through cheating, the wrong way. When the wrong way happens, sometimes does materialize. However, it's not necessarily a right to function perfectly. And then we find a lot of difficulties within the presidency and all that type of thing.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek, who is going to be here in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, November 7th, at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church on Barcelona Road. And he will be signing his new book, Good Life, Good Death: Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation. One of the things that you write about in the book is the difference between attachment and pure love. Now, how can those things be separated when virtually everybody who feels that they've experienced true love also pretty much feels attachment to the object of their true love?
True, but you know the difference is a simple way of putting the attachment is a sticky stuff, and the pure love is not a sticky stuff. I'm sorry to say that, but you know, the attachment has a lot of stickiness, and the pure love doesn't have that. It's a very simple way of putting it, saying it. Yes.
But it's pretty hard to feel non-attached love. Is it not?
Apparently not. We are so used to it for the attraction and the attachment as reading as a love. But a really, truly pure love has no personal desire of anything. It is simply love. And it is sort of really wishing the individual well. And not only just to wish, but making the individual well and happy as you are, whatever the person wanted. In that way, that is a pure love, honestly. And the love, what we call it love, sometimes, you know, have that, as I tried to say earlier, sticky stuff, which means we project something on the individual. So you may say, like, you know, for example, you may say, hey, you look so fantastic, wonderful, I love you, you're great. However, I think your hair will be a little shorter than what you have, it will be nicer. Or a little longer than what you have, it will be nicer. Let's try that one. Let's do that. Hey, your lipstick is too bright. Make it a little bit of darker or softer or gentler. So conditions imposing by the other side to the object on which really means the individual personal putting your projection on that person, which really indicates not the appreciation of what you are, who you are, but more than you know, the imagination or exaggeration of the other person putting on you, and that becomes sticky stuff.
So we started off talking about how consciousness is neither created nor destroyed, but the appearance of human beings on the planet Earth is fairly recent in the history of the Earth. Was there Buddha consciousness before human beings evolved? Did it exist?
According to the Buddha's teaching, and every consciousness is old consciousness, every Buddha's consciousness is old consciousness. So therefore, I believe it is existing even way before the Big Bang or whatever, you know, or before that.
So here's another question, and it's just a math question, and maybe it's not even a good question, but there's many, many more creatures on Earth that there were, you know, even 1,000 years ago, certainly many more people. How are there enough souls to fill all the new lives if there's reincarnation?
What happened is, you know, every human beings are not always human beings. Every creature is not always the same creature. But when they change their life, their consciousness take a different birth. Not only this universe, what we are living today, is the only universe, according to the Buddha's teaching. And there's a multi-galaxy of the universe in the world. I mean, it exists. And each one of them exchanges individual person. You know, after dying, their consciousness is without the physical body. They transport each other from the different universe to different universe and take a rebirth in different universes. And that's why is not a new creation of consciousness, but old creation of consciousness, but traveling from one existence to another existence. And that's why there's no shortage of beings.
So in Buddhist teaching, are there beings in other galaxies who are Buddhas?
Yes, tremendous. Tremendous galaxies, and tremendous galaxies have beings. So the close encounter with the third kind is nothing surprise in Buddhist people. I'm sorry, you know.
Right, right. Is there a relationship between reincarnation and genetics? For example, do certain types of souls reincarnate into genetically very sensitive bodies or very insensitive bodies?
No, to me, it is the genetic, the genes tradition is, you know, that comes from the parents through children and grandchildren and so on and forth. It is the one genetic line, physical genetic line that will run. Similarly, we got this mental sort of gene that nobody calls a gene, right? Sort of a mental continuation. And that comes in when that crossed, crisscrossed. When that crisscrossed, and then the people take their birth, and so the mental continuation connects with the genetic continuation, and then the mental continuation occupies the genetic continuation, and that's how life functions. That's my understanding of Buddha's understanding of relationship between this physical and mind.
Some of the book is devoted not so much to an understanding of the, the process of taking birth and rebirth and so on, but to the actual living a decent life, as you say. And there's a chapter on anger and patience. When anger arises, as it does in virtually everybody, it should be neither expressed nor suppressed. What does one do in Buddhist teachings with anger?
And I have a very nice chapter on that, as you mentioned, on dealing with anger. According to the Buddha's teachings, the direct antidote of anger is patience. However, we need to build a bridge between the patience and patience working against the anger. Because, you know, in our life, when you get angry, be patient, doesn't really make you deal easily. So it is really what we require is the understanding. The understanding of where the individual stands. And when you really understand the reality of what's happening, and the understanding itself will help us tremendously to reduce the anger. Not only that, also to recognize, to acknowledge that the individual is being angry. Upset, angry. Normally we deny, I'm not angry, but blah, 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 we say all this. But this is a clear sign that we're not happy, we're upset, but we don't acknowledge. So not only understand, but acknowledge. Acknowledge that I am angry. On the basis of my understanding, I'm angry. By recognizing that I am angry, which really reduces the tremendous power of anger, because somehow we have a natural knowledge saying that anger, hatred is not good. So because when you begin to look at yourself, you will be shy. You feel shame that I was angry. So which really reduces the hot air that we pumped up so much. So because of that, Because of that, the anger power goes down tremendously. We feel a little embarrassed even. So, but then it gives us opportunity to look in and apply patience or do whatever, or compassion or love or whatever, give us opportunity. So the acknowledgement and the recognition and understanding, all of them really work well against anger. And on top of that, then apply compassion, love, and patience, or whatever, so then you really can defeat anger, and which is very good for human beings to defeat anger.
And it makes their next life a lot more pleasant than this life, apparently.
Not only the next life, even this life, a person becomes much happier, more relaxed, more calm. Your blood pressure will be lower. Excuse me. And all these are, you know, good effect in there. Yes.
I have one more question that's related to this. Suppose that you have negative emotions, whether they be anger or anxiety or depression or any of those things, and you are able to resolve them through a change of diet or eating herbs or eating medicines or things like that. Is that just as good in the spirit Tibetan worldview as doing it through meditation practice and understanding?
Diet is very helpful, but it might not necessarily directly work against the mental negative emotions, because it is a mind activity, and the diet will be physical activity. There's a tremendous relationship between the diet and between the physical and the mind. But however, the diet alone will make a hell of a difference in the mind. Immediately is a difficulty. But within the period, you know, like if you try to be eating right for a week or so continuously, and then you will definitely feel different the next week. And that is the relationship between the physical body and the mind is very strong, but not immediately affect, like recognize that I was angry. And then, you know, oops, if other people knew that I am angry, I will be very embarrassed. Or even no one else know, I'll be ashamed of myself if I'm so angry like this. And that will have a direct effect on anger because it is mental activity. Physical activities will have an indirect effect, which will take a little time. Maybe a week or so, maybe more. Excuse me. Yeah.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek. So you are, according to your tradition, the reincarnation of a previous lama. Do you have to learn your wisdom teachings all over again?
For me, I had to study like a dog, honestly. Mm-hmm. But a little bit of easier memorizing certain textbooks here and there. Otherwise, everything I have to do very hard working. And without hard working, this subject is extremely complicated and it's very difficult. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I really worked hard and suffered tremendously. Try to learn and pick up that.
It's funny because right at the beginning of the book, you talk about how it was very hard for you to grasp and understand the whole idea of reincarnation. But then when you meet Americans and start talking about it, they're completely open to it. What's that all about?
True, because Americans are very open-minded and extremely, whether they understand or not understand. But, you know, they heard the word, and they're very interested, and they're very open. And that amazes me. And even, you know, when I first came in the United States in mid-80s, I hesitated to talk meditation even for a while. And then one day in one of those lectures that I'm giving, so I mentioned meditation. And suddenly people started moving and adjusting their sitting posture and all that. So I said, ooh. So, you know, I was the one who was hesitating to say, but there looks like they're waiting for me to show and do something. And it sort of amazes me always, the surprise all the time.
Rinpoche Nawang Gelek is the author of the book Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation, published by Riverhead Press. And he will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, November 7th at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church here in Santa Fe, New Mexico at 107 West Barcelona Road. And the talk is titled Engaging Wisdom and Compassion. Thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Jo Whaley. She is an artist. She's a teacher at the College of Santa Fe, and she has a new book of photographs titled The Theater of Insects, published by Chronicle Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Charlotte.
And Linda Wiener joins us. She's an entomologist. She's a tutor at St. John's College right here in Santa Fe, and she's contributed an essay to this book as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's talk, Joe, about the inspiration for this book. It's photographs of insects as art.
Yes. Well, the insects themselves, as is elucidated in Linda's essay, have this incredible inherent aesthetic quality in their structures and designs, and that's what got me hooked into photographing them as subject matter to begin with, is just the way they looked and the kind of wonder of the just innocent wonder of nature. And this book wouldn't have to be insects, it could be plants, it could be anything that's in nature, but this particular one is focusing on insects.
And so you set them up as still lifes with all sorts of different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are old photographs, some of them are kind of old-fashioned, what look like scientific drawings, some of them are abstract backgrounds.
Actually, they're all the backgrounds are man-made objects that have been taken back by nature halfway. So if they're photographs, they're from the early, the late 1800s, early 20th century, and they are, how should I describe it? They're deteriorated, they're decayed. So if it's of a person, this photograph shows not only is the person dead and gone, but their image is even decayed, and that's reflecting of the kind of vanitas notion, and that everything decays and goes. And so what I'm looking at in the backgrounds is this in-between place where it's man-made, but because nature has taken it back either through rust or oxidation or any type of natural weathering, it has this beautiful mutation. And it's reflecting the place where our world is right now, which is in between this kind of constructed environment and a natural environment.
The insects themselves are relatively pristine in comparison.
Mm-hmm. They're representing pure nature.
And they're not alive, but how did you get these insects and how did you choose among them?
Well, some of them are alive, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it's like the millipedes and the walking stick. And the others are pinned insects, and I've collected them over the many years, actually, through largely this entomologist in Berkeley, where I live part of the year. He has this funky little shop called the Bone Room, and beautiful specimens from all over the world.
Now, Linda Wiener, you talk in your book about the beauty and mystery that you found in insects and in nature when you were a little girl, and then the contrast between that and the way science regards these same creatures.
Yes, that's right. And it seems to me that science is often trying to sort of claim insects and other natural things in nature as just sort of their own territory, and they don't really want other views to have at least a kind of real credence in the world. But I'm just, it's, to me, it's certain kinds of questions are answered most fruitfully by looking through a scientific lens, but a lot of other kinds of questions about nature are answered far more fruitfully by looking through art or even a kind of religious sense, it seems to me, and that those things are real. They're not just kind of weird projections that we're putting on them, but that they're part of nature.
What's a question about nature that can be better answered through art?
Well, this kind of the questions about the aesthetics in nature, I think, are brought out and illuminated through the kind of photographs in this book. It brings out the kind of these aesthetic qualities. You can look at a butterfly or a beetle in purely aesthetic terms and talk about it that way, and it's as legitimate as talking about a painting that way. Those things are present in the insect. And to try to take that kind of beauty and aesthetics and talk about it purely in terms of a kind of utilitarian view of nature, I think takes away more than it adds.
What is the, shall we say, adaptive the adaptive significance of the perception of beauty that we human beings have as we've evolved? We seem to have evolved as a species to recognize and love beauty. What good does that do? I mean, maybe it's a utilitarian question, but what good does that do us?
Well, I just think it makes our lives fuller. But whether that, what kind of utility is that? Is that the kind of utility that makes you have more babies? Well, I don't know. Maybe, but I don't think you have to, I don't think we should be forced to always give that kind of an answer. Part of something I've been doing lately is just doing a little investigation of other animals that do collect and decorate. And it turns out there's far more than I ever thought.
Really?
And they're all across.
Like it's, what?
Well, I mean, in amongst birds, a lot of the raven group, the parrots, the bowerbirds, there's a penguin that does collecting and stores little shiny things. Amongst mammals, ferrets do it, pack rats do it, raccoons do it. They'll just collect things that they like, and they'll put them in their
nest.
They say,
I'm going to hang this in my nest.
Well, that's right. And then a nest, then just like we think of we want homes and not just places to stay dry, I think that's common also in many, many animals. It's not just a hole in the ground. It's a home, and you make it that by doing this kind of collecting and decorating. So there's a, I don't know that this is necessarily adaptive, or maybe it even could be, but it seems that there's something below the adaptation level, a kind of natural aesthetic that a lot of fish and octopus and other animals have just as well as we do.
Fish?
Yeah, there's some fish that decorate their little holes.
Their coral reefs?
Well, if you have a coral reef, that's great. Then you hardly need to decorate. but other fish actually gather things and, shiny and pretty things and put it around their little holes. And some of this you might say, well, it's to attract females, and maybe it does. But some of it really doesn't seem to function that way. And I don't think we need to try to force it to. I think we can say, well, maybe it helps them have more babies, but maybe there's just something about this desire for beauty that's really very widespread, and we shouldn't try to always just force it into what good is it.
We're talking to Linda Wiener and Joe Whaley about the new book of photographs, The Theater of Insects, and there will be a lecture. Are both of you speaking tonight at Tipton Hall?
Unfortunately, Linda can't join me.
So it'll be
so
Joe
sorry.
Whaley,
yes.
who will be speaking at Tipton Hall tonight, November 6th at what time?
Oh, at 6 o'clock.
At 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And there will be a book signing tomorrow, November 7th, at the Photo Eye Gallery, and an exhibition of these works will run through the end of December. In your essay, Linda, you talk about the philosopher Bergson and the contrast between the instincts of insects and the creative intelligence of human beings. And I was thinking about that.
are they really distinct, those two things, instinct and creative intelligence?
I don't think that they're completely distinct, and I think he doesn't either, but he just thinks that the insects really develop the instincts to the highest degree, and that the kind of line that leads to humans develop that creative intelligence to the highest degree, but that he thinks that they're both really basic, important tendencies in nature, but they're just sort of exhibited in the best way by these two different groups. They're not completely separate. You could think of lots of examples where.
Well, I mean, it seems
mix.
Like maybe an individual insect isn't isn't Mozart, but taken together, I mean, the insects that you show in your book are like works of art themselves, and in what they do and the way they look, they're as amazing a creation as any artwork.
Right.
Absolutely. That's why I got hooked on it. I said, why do I have to make these incredible narrative photographs like I was doing before with these elaborate stage scenes? Why not just photograph the thing itself? It's just so incredible. And then it got carried away.
How big are these photographs?
Oh, that's a good question to ask, because in the book, they're small. We wanted the book to look like a kind of tattered field guide.
Right.
And photographs are such that the size of the insect is the same size as a human head or larger, so that the viewer will confront the image. And they're like environmental portraits. It's a one-to-one relationship, which calls into question man's perceived dominance over nature. So you're on an equal footing with a moth, just as you are as fragile as a moth.
It is interesting, especially when an insect is blown up that large as an image, that there's kind of a fine line between it being beautiful and it being really disgusting.
Correct. I mean, the moths have these kind of hairy backs, and you often see the scales of the butterfly wings, which are these kind of overlapping shingles built on the framework of the wings. So they become a bit menacing, and that's, you know, that dichotomy is what holds a lot of tension in the image. It's good.
Linda, you talked about in your essay the meaning, the double meaning of the word psyche from the Greek.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just interested me that they had the same word
for
soul and for butterfly. And so that that's in some ways, whenever you say one, you're evoking the other. And there's a series of the photographs in the book that takes on that theme. The daguerreotypes that are fading out and the butterflies, those are...
And I should say that Linda and I, in this wonderful little town of Santa Fe, the way this book was evolved is that we would have regular conversations at downtown subscriptions in the courtyard. And we would just kind of, you know, bounce off of each other these ideas. And I did these images of the old photographs after she told me this concept. It's not a theory, it's a concept of, you know, soul and butterfly being the same word, and the notion of it being psyche. And it just, you know, all these ideas just kind of exploded in my mind, and I went to the studio and made them in reflection to her conversation. So we've been having this wonderful back and forth
collaboration. It really was one. We would look at all these old Victorian natural history books or earlier ones on insects and just look at it. There's a kind of aesthetic that the Victorians had that it's not non-scientific, but it's more than that. The art of that period before you started just relying on a kind of I think photography has taken over in some ways from a lot of the drawing, and it's often not as good even to identify an insect, but it certainly doesn't add this. There's an attempt to kind of take out the other dimension, the artistic
personality.
Dimension, the personality. So we spent a lot of time looking at some of these old books and talking about what they were trying to do in these old illustrations.
And I was really influenced by Linda's notion of the aesthetic drive in nature, going beyond what is necessary for survival.
The book is The Theater of Insects. Joe Whaley is an artist. Linda Weiner is an entomologist, tutor at St. John's, and she contributed an essay to the book. And Joe Whaley will be at Tipton Hall tonight at 6 o'clock, and that's on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. And there will be an opening and book signing tomorrow at the Photo Eye Gallery. At what time?
5 to 7.
From 5 to 7. And there will be a show there that runs through the end of December. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow with Robert Knott and with our animal segment with Bill Hutchison. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR and KSFR.org. Ciao.